When Dota Williams was young, she played the violin and loved making things. She is now a luthier, a violin maker, and she also repairs and restores fine quality violins. Carolyn finds out more.
Dota, thank you very much for taking the time this morning to talk to me about your work as a luthier in Norfolk. Now, I understand you knew from a very young age what you wanted to do, and it's an interesting story. Could you tell me a little bit more?
Yes. Well, I played the violin as a child, and I always used to like making things, so it kind of stemmed from that, really. And the violin maker that I used to take my violin to, he had the most amazing workshop. It was just magical, actually. And I think from that, I just developed that idea that I wanted to be a violin maker. So I asked him if I could go there, and he said yes, and which was lovely. So I used to go on Saturday mornings and school holidays here and there and just help him in his workshop. Initially, I used to do things like cleaning the instruments and fitting pegs, just little bits here and there that he would ask me to do, and it sort of carried on from there. And then with his encouragement, I applied to go to Newark Violin Making School in the UK from my hometown of Melbourne, which was quite exciting, actually. So I applied there, and I came over for an interview, and I had to do drawing and woodwork test and such, and I was lucky enough to be accepted. So I went to Newark, and the rest is history, really. So yeah.
And from training, do you enter an apprenticeship?
No, well, some people might, but the route that I took was I worked for Roger Buckmaster in Melbourne, and then I went to Newark Violin Making School, and that's a 3-year course full time, so which was amazing. When I went there, I went from 92 to 95, and we had a mix of tutors who were professional luthiers and also lecturers. So there was quite a variety of different sort of techniques and methods that they would use, all very traditional, but one might be a bit more quicker in, show us a different way to do one job than the other, or they each had their absolute specialties and talents. And it was just an amazing place to go to learn and pick up ideas. And of course, all the students, we were all really enthusiastic, and so we would do our own research and lots of exchanging of ideas. And it was just a great place, and I actually met my husband there, Alan. So, and he's also a violin maker as well. So he trained as a carpenter originally, and he came in from that angle. So we both love violin. So
you restore and you make instruments, I understand. Enjoy both.
I enjoy doing both. Although they're sort of related, because they're violin based, and some of the I think you do need to understand how a violin is made to restore one. However, there are different techniques, and I went and worked for a restorer who taught me. I mean, I learnt at college repairs. We had a great lecturer there, and he showed us, repair techniques, sort of like peg bushings, which is like when the peg holes where you have your pegs, over time they gradually get bigger and bigger and they wear away. So, you would bush the holes, and that's considered more of a basic repair in violin making. But you sort of have to retouch the varnish, and you fit the wood, cut it back, retouch the varnish, then fit new pegs. And things like a neck graft as well. So if the neck became broken on an instrument, or you wanted to turn an instrument from a Baroque period instrument to a modern violin, the neck needs to be changed, because you need to lengthen it, and also the neck shape is slightly different. So we learned things like that, crack repairs and a bit of retouching. And then, so after college, I worked for a restorer, and that was more specialist restorations, things like, edgings and cracks and just a variety of different.
Is that typically where damage would happen with an instrument?
Yeah, when you're playing, I think the most common things would be like knocks to the corners. You might sort of scuff the varnish, possibly if your bow, or someone might walk past you and accidentally knock your instrument. Things like that. They're sort of more the basic accidents that can happen. The more drastic is, say, someone might put an instrument on a chair, which is probably a bit of a no-no, really, and you might sit on it, for example, or something might get dropped on an instrument, or instruments get dropped. There's so many different ways that they do get broken, sadly. But generally, anything can be put back together in that world. It's just whether or not it's economical. Okay. So sometimes you do need to say that's the end of the road. But, you know, if an instrument is worth a lot of money, then you absolutely would try and restore it. When I first started violin making, I actually used some Australian woods because, firstly, my woodworking skills were rubbish, and I think it would have been cruel to use really expensive woods. But having said that, one of them did sound okay. I mean, yeah, I haven't made anything in recent times with Australian woods, but some people do and they have great success. But for me, the most success I've had is with European tone woods.
Aww.
But again, that could be too that my violin making skills have definitely progressed since then, because I hadn't gone to Newark and had proper professional training. So,
which Australian woods would you be looking at?
I use some mountain ash for mine, and I can't even remember the name of another one, but I also used I think it was called King Billy Pine as well. When I look back, I think I was probably more focused on just making a violin at that point as opposed to making one that sounded great. So it was a hot, because I hadn't learnt woodwork before, bizarrely, before I decided I wanted to become a violin maker. It was an all-in-one package. So when I went to Roger Buckmaster's workshop, I was learning woodwork at the same time. So, yeah, it would have been silly for me to start off with expensive woods when I was really just in training. So,
and in terms of sustainability, do you have is that going to become more of an issue with making violin?
Absolutely, and it's already having an impact. Things like ebony, it's very slow growing, and that there are already companies who are looking at different sort of more carbon fiber based products, you know, man-made products for fingerboards, tailpieces. You know, I think as, you know, the centuries go on, we are going to gear away from using some of the traditional woods that perhaps for fittings we use. The ebony that I obtained comes from India, and often it comes through Germany as well, because it, you know, will be treated and such. I have some blanks, just logs of ebony that I bought years and years and years ago, and if I want little pieces, I just saw a bit off, so... Mm. But when you can, ebony is such a beautiful wood, actually, because it can look, you know, when you see it, it's often very black and shiny. But when you start working with it, it's not often like that. You might have a bit of other colours in it as well. So, and then you sort of polish it with oils and that, and then suddenly all the black stains over. And yeah, you can actually make it look
beautiful.
I mean, it's already beautiful, but it really. It's lovely, and a fingerboard, you know, you can absolutely burnish it, so it's, it just feels like glass. It's so so polished, and the pegs as well. A lot of pegs traditionally are ebony or fruit dyed fruit wood to look black.
The peg you twist at the top,
the tuning
of the
pegs. Yes.
The tuning pegs.
Yeah, so they're ebony, but also traditionally. Rosewood was used for pegs
very
as well.
Very hard again.
A very hard wood, but that again is now endangered. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the woods as well, you have to be very careful when you travel about now with instruments. So if you have things like ivory on your instrument, say you're like a baroque instrument, you may have had an ivory nut or an ivory saddle or rosewood pegs, you know, you need to be careful where you travel.
And the saddle is what?
The saddle is at the end of on the bottom of the violin, I call it. So it's the area where there's a lot of pressure. So your strings are held in place literally by the tailpiece, which is connected to an end pin in the bottom of the rib, the lower rib. But the saddle is the area on the top of the front plate, the tail gut, is connected to the tail pin. I'm trying to describe it so people understand, sorry.
Yes.
So where the end pin and the tail piece are connected. So it's like a tail gut. And
which you would then attach the strings to.
Yes. And so then that's going to override. So all that pressure is going to push down on that part of the plate. So the saddle is that area of the plate. And because the front would actually probably crack if you just left it normal wood.
When you tighten the strings.
Yeah, when you tighten the strings and applied all that pressure. So it is replaced. Traditionally, it was a lower piece of wood or could be bone or ivory. But as time's gone on, generally it can be rosewood or also ebony, but at a higher angle.
Right.
So
I was really intrigued, and I really have to admit my ignorance, that I didn't know that there is a Baroque violin and a modern violin.
That's right.
Could you tell me a little bit about the differences?
Yes. So a Baroque violin is how the violin looked traditionally, probably 400, if you went back 400 years ago. And the main difference are that the neck is shorter. The neck is a slightly heavier shape to the traditional one. The bass bar is shorter, which is a bar that runs inside on the inside of the front plate. And the fingerboard is shorter. Also, the tailpiece is slightly different. It's not as curved. It's got a flatter curve. The bridge also is very different. The curve is slightly flatter, slightly different radius. And the bridge just generally more ornate. The fingerboard also has a flatter curve as well, and the strings is crucial. So generally you've got a gut string on the the E and the A on a violin, and then the D and the G could be a gut with, say, a silver winding, metal winding or copper winding over them. And the neck is mortised differently. So on the Baroque violin, the neck is simply hammered home, flushed, glued, hammered in or screwed in. Whereas on a violin of modern setup, because of the higher pitch, you need much more strength, so it's mortised in.
Yes. So hence why Vivaldi and Handel sound so different from Elgar and Dvorak when they're playing.
Absolutely. So if you have a different, if you play the same piece of music on a different violin at a different concert pitch, it will sound completely different.
Dota, thank you so much for giving us a overview. I'm sure there's so much more we could talk about making violins, but thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
For taking the trouble to talk to us today.
Caroline was talking to Dota Williams.